Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Jamie Pauls.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 126 for October 2nd, 2012. I'm Jamie Pauls.
Thank you, Jamie of Borg, but I think you're going to scare the listeners if you host the podcast. So I'm going to take over hosting for October 2nd, 2012. I'm Ricky Enger.
I'm Lisa Salinger.
And I'm Buddy Brannon.
Woohoo! Welcome to a happy podcast, which...
A happy podcast of fun.
Ooh, podcast of fun. Happy Fun Cast instead of Happy Fun Ball. Have you ever heard the Happy Fun Ball skit from Saturday Night Live where you do not taunt Happy Fun Ball, keep Happy Fun Ball out of reach of children? But yes, welcome to. you probably did. It's quite funny. You should take my word for it, or go and find it on YouTube yourself. We'll probably talk about it on End of Line at some point, so you can look forward to that. In any case, let's jump right into the news, and I should inform you all that
you don't know the power of the dark side
of Wikipedia, or Wikidpedia, as the article refers to it. This is basically talking about, with Wikipedia, it's supposed to be a very open service where users who are experts in a particular field or basically, any random user is supposed to be able to submit and edit articles for Wikipedia, but that's not always how it works out.
Yeah, sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes an expert is not an expert, especially if he's the author of the thing that he's supposed to be the expert on.
Yeah, it turns out that Philip Roth submitted an edit to an article that had been published about one of his novels, and he disputed what was in that article, and the Wikipedia people responded saying, yeah, we know you're the author of the work and all, but we actually need more than one source to be able to confirm this and include it in the article.
Never mind that about half of the stuff that you see on Wikipedia always says citation needed. And of course, anybody can edit something, and if you're lucky, you can edit something and your edit will stick, but you can also edit something and then your edit could disappear in half an hour because somebody else decides to edit it again. The good news about Wikipedia is that it's open and anybody can contribute. The bad news about Wikipedia is that it's open and anybody can contribute.
Exactly. And you can't, I think that unfortunately with Wikipedia, the adage about I read it on the internet, so it must be true, is doubly so for Wikipedia because for whatever reason, people want to view this as a credible source. You'll see students writing their papers and citing things from Wikipedia and all sorts of things. And so what happens when some idiot comes in and spews forth a lot of imaginative things that turn out not to be facts?
I think we're pretty hardwired, really, to, and I'm saying we as a society are pretty hardwired to think that if something appears in print, it must be so. Because it's only been in recent years that people can write anything and put it on the internet. I'd be interested to see some sort of demographics about how literally people took things that they read in print based on their age. I would suspect that older people, and I don't know older than what, are more susceptible to this than our younger people because there's just such a proliferation of material, such a huge amount that there wasn't before. And hopefully people are getting smart and are moving away from the adage that if I see it in print, or in our case, if I hear it in print, it must be so.
Do you remember that article? Do you remember that long time ago when there was a spoof article in The Onion about how J.K. Rowling was a devil worshiper or something like that, and all the fundamentalist, total anti-anything magic people wacky.
Yes.
Like took that and run with it. Hey, the Onion said that, that, you know, so it must be true. Yeah,
the Onion is a credible source.
Yeah, because that's right.
I do love the Onion though.
Oh, the Onion's fantastic, but for people to actually think that it was a credible news source because, well, I found it on the internet and it looks like a newspaper, so it really must be it.
It must be.
So this isn't really anything terribly new. And, you know, we've been warned forever, as long as I can think of, by people who know about things like this, that Wikipedia can't be considered a credible source just because it's not verified and fact-checked and cross-checked and all that sort of thing. So Wikipedia is not the Encyclopedia Britannica.
No, or, I just think that people tend to want it to be. And
oh, sure.
I wonder how many teachers will allow citations from Wikipedia, because I know a lot of students who use it. I just don't know if they get in trouble for that. No, you got to verify it elsewhere too.
I think it would depend on the kind of citation. If you're talking a medical condition, or, for example, the use of herbal products to treat some sort of condition, they might not. But if it's popular cultural trends, maybe. I don't know.
Pretty interesting.
This is loosely related to discussions that have been had here before about privacy. And, you know, there are various issues that come up. Dropbox passwords, and this on Facebook, and this person had their identity stolen. And really, they're all saying the same thing. They're all singing the same song. What you thought was private isn't private. You have to be careful. You have to be savvy. And it's kind of like that with Wikipedia. What you thought was credible may not be credible, and you've really got to judge for yourself. You just can't take it at face value.
Yeah, you got to do a little research, do your homework. And you might be doing that on a tablet. Turns out that apparently 1 in 4 people are using a tablet as their primary machine now. And I don't think this spells the death of the PC. It's an interesting trend, especially if you consider that a couple of years ago, tablets were not a thing. You know, say 3 or 4 years ago, there were very few people who had tablets, and now it's sort of becoming a mainstay in a lot of households. But people still are using PCs or laptops, or desktops or laptops, and I don't expect that to change anytime soon.
Well, keep in mind what the tablet is really good at. The tablet's really good at data consumption, at streaming media, at viewing web pages, at looking at stuff, which is what a lot of people do with the computer. A lot of people don't use a computer for a lot of really serious number crunching or editing of audio and video and serious work. A lot of people have used the PC in their homes as a media consumption device. So it makes a lot of sense that something that's specifically designed for that and really good at that would be something that is used primarily by 1/4 of people to do that, because that's what they were using PCs for, and tablets are a lot better at that for certain people. Melanie is one of those people. She never was really comfortable with the computer. She's definitely somebody that anything out of the ordinary happens to it, she doesn't know what to do about it. And guess who gets to be tech support for my house?
Oh, that's fun.
But her iPad, she loves her iPad. When she had her iPad stolen last year, she was lost for a week until we got her a new one. So, yeah, this doesn't surprise me in the least.
No, and I think some people are buying them, or maybe some children, let's get mom and dad an iPad or another tablet. Because, you know, in one sense, the manufacturers of these things, or the trendsetters or whoever, have done themselves a great favor by calling it a tablet. If they even called it, I don't know, a recreational device,
a portable computer, or
yes,
yeah.
This is a friendly word. It's as easy as picking up a tablet, you know? I think you have that. I think you have, like was already said, this is primarily being used for consumption, for recreation, with a little bit of maybe work thrown in. But, you know, especially if you have people who haven't grown up with computers, they want a way to look at pictures and FaceTime with the grandkids, and, you know, it just works for them. My dad recently got an iPad, and he's loving it because he doesn't have to carry the laptop around anymore, and he really wasn't doing what could be considered hardcore computing. He was reading, replying to emails, you know, looking up information that he needed. And I think it would be interesting to have this breakdown done by task, because I've heard repeatedly that, you know, where tablets don't excel is word processing. And I've seen this even using the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can do basics, and I could do more than basics if I wanted to spend a long time, but it's not as simple.
Not as comfortable.
You were talking about how people want to just pick it up and use it. Well, the other thing about that is, you know, these touch screens with the multi-touch gestures and all that, people want to just point at something and say, yeah, I want that one.
Yeah.
Not so easy to do with the mouse. And as far as touch screens, I think Apple really had a point last year when they were talking about, I think it was last year, they were talking about touch screens and how the iPad was really ideal, that they played with touch screens and that because they were vertical and they weren't really convenient for people to just touch, they were fatiguing in that way. A touch screen, I don't think, would offer even a similar experience to a tablet, just because it's a screen and it's vertical and
you'd have to kind of cock your wrist at some weird angle just to touch stuff. It would not be pleasant.
Yeah.
And the mouse doesn't really do the same thing. The mouse is sort of an intermediary between you and what you're wanting to access, whereas it seems to me that a tablet would be a lot more intuitive for people, so it's less of a logical
leap. You touch it and it goes.
It's a more direct interface without the middleman of a mouse or even a keyboard in one sense.
Yeah.
And it's funny when you're talking about the touch screens. I was saying to a friend of mine the other week that when I was in high school and I was learning to write my name, to sign my name, the paper was always supposed to be turned at an angle. And I never got that. And I always managed somehow to turn it back so it was straight up and down. So now I've got the iPhone. And if I'm doing regular typing, not as we've mentioned here before, like Flexi, that's to me is a totally different hand position. But if I'm just inputting a few letters, I find that I hold my iPhone on a slant. And
interesting.
I was just thinking, oh, you know, leave it to me. It's a little idiosyncratic. And my friend said, well, what you're probably subconsciously doing is holding it in such a way, because I hold it in my left hand, that when you're inputting text with your right hand, your wrist is not fatiguing.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, which I thought was very clever. And this is a similar thing. I mean, it can be put at whatever angle, whether you're talking angled up from the flat surface in front of you, or I doubt many would angle that on a slant, but you can
flip
it
portrait and landscape and all sorts of cool stuff.
It's more, it really is more, I think, just of a direct interaction, and I think that's also what they have going for them.
And I think tablets are wonderful, but I don't feel that PCs are becoming obsolete.
No.
Now, but there are a few
a
office technologies
story.
That are. I'll be glad to see this go away.
See, I'm really skeptical of articles like this because, okay, I'm gonna say two words and I want to get your reaction to this. Paperless office.
Huh?
No.
Yeah, exactly. How long have we been promised a paperless office?
Offices have generated more paper in the...
paperless. Yeah, there are statistics on this. Like since people have been able to print stuff at will, we've generated more paper than ever. So when I see articles that say, well, the fax machine's going away, we're going to more digital technologies and so forth, I'm skeptical.
I'd love it if the fax did go away, but some of them do make sense. Like, I think the Rolodex is certainly going to become less popular. I won't say that it'll go away forever.
Some people just like the analog paper thing.
Yeah.
As far as things like the fax machine and whatnot, like I say, I don't know. I'm skeptical because, like I say, we've been promised a paperless office at least since I was a kid. That's been at least 30 years. We still don't have it. They mentioned things like the tape recorder. Well, the tape recorder hasn't really disappeared.
It hasn't gone away.
Just that
it's evolved.
No, exactly. We've just lost the tape. Yeah. It's a chip now. It's not a tape anymore, but we still have personal recorders. For example, doctors and so forth still do stuff with dictation and instead of putting it on a tape for a transcriber, it goes through some digital thing, but essentially it's a tape recorder, except not with tape.
Yeah, and there were a few I just flat out didn't agree with.
Office phone? No. No, the office phone.
That's not going anywhere.
Exactly.
Not going anywhere.
That was one. And the other, this could be, I guess, an example similar to the tape recorder, and that is they're saying the USB drive is going to go away. I don't see that for a long time, if ever.
This is Tech Pundit's pushing cloud storage. That's what that is.
Yeah, but also I think it's a writer saying, oh, I only have 8, and top 8 just doesn't have the same ring as top 10.
Yeah, there you go.
But I mean, most of them, it was like, maybe. And I got to those two, and I thought, are you crazy?
No.
I just don't see it.
Standard working hours is one that I think, unfortunately, is disappearing, and I would rather it didn't, because I think that we're all so plugged in all the time that, you know, in a sense, there is an advantage to punching a time clock, because you know when it's okay to walk away and you don't run the risk of allowing your work life to become your entire life.
I think this is going to be a pendulum. We're going to see them go away, and then it's going to swing back, because you can't maintain, and I think this was used as a podcast title way back and coined by Ricky, and it's so appropriate, the cat-like state of readiness. You can't maintain that all the time. And finding a balance sometimes is really hard. And like, I've thought about, okay, how do I balance this? If people aren't even giving it any consideration, I mean, I think people are going to burn out, and then we're going to see that pendulum switch back so that,
you know.
5:01, sorry, I'm done, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah, there's an article that I have that was posted on Twitter last year. I think it was in Mother Jones, and I haven't favored it if anybody's interested. But it talks about that very thing about people sort of unplugging from work and how we're less likely to do that, more reluctant to do that sort of thing. I'll have to find that and send it. But it's an interesting article.
Well, let's talk iPhones and people who whine about them.
What is this iPhone of which you speak?
It's the thing that everybody is so disappointed about and whining about.
So disappointed that they've sold 5 million of them.
Yes, yeah. that little device. But apparently some early adopters are having problems with this. So I haven't experienced any of these things.
You mean you don't see that little sliver of light?
No, I somehow do not. They're talking about light leaks. And the one I, quote, loved was Scuffgate. Oh, it's a big conspiracy.
I'm getting sick of all these gates. You know?
Yeah.
All this gate stuff is just ridiculous. I mean, like Watergate was like Watergate because it was the name of something. It was like the name of an actual hotel. And now everything is a freaking gate, and it's just annoying.
Clever.
And it's like not clever at all.
A couple of times, but not so much.
Yeah. I think I will no longer say that I'm blind. I'll say that I have a dark leak.
A dark leak.
Or a darkness leak or something instead of the light leak.
There you go.
I love it.
But the fact of the matter is that whenever there's a product launch, doesn't matter what it is, and when you're talking about huge numbers especially, you're going to find there are going to be some units that have problems.
Yeah.
Even if it's not a launch, when you're talking about huge numbers, you're going to have a certain percentage of units that have problems. It's just,
yeah, there are going to be issues. It doesn't matter who you are.
Right.
Yeah.
But because it's Apple and because they're huge and because everybody's scrutinizing them, it's a huge deal.
Yes. And Apple is handling this well. They are saying that if your phones exhibit any of these things, not necessarily the scuffs and scratches on the aluminum back, I don't think, unless you were opening it in front of them and saying, hey, see, look, you know, then they might replace it. But for the light issue and a few of the others that are here on the list, Apple is going to replace your phone if you find some of these things going on.
That's something that I've really agreed with, and I forget where I first saw it, but I saw it. It was a ham radio list, I think. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Somebody said that every company is going to have problems. Every product is going to have problems. That's not important. What is important and what really matters is how the company handles the problem and what they do about it. And I think that in this case, I think Apple's dealing with it appropriately and correctly.
I think Apple is actually doing very well in terms of handling negative feedback after this launch. There's always negative feedback when you get a new OS or a new phone release, because again, Apple is so newsworthy and people are scrutinizing them. But let's take maps, for instance. We have an article in Consumer Reports, for one, and there you can basically, all over the web, you can't swing a cat without hitting an article about how bad the maps are. Mm-hmm. And Tim Cook has written an email or a letter, an open letter to the consumers saying, you know what? You're right. Maps is not good right now. We are working very hard to make this better. We understand that you're expecting something world class. And guess what? We didn't give you that this time. So while we're working on this stuff, go use Bing Maps. Go use Google Maps. There's Nokia Maps. He mentions several competitor products in this open letter, and basically just said,
not to mention all the stuff in the App Store.
Yeah. Oh, and there's there are plenty of map apps in the App Store.
And he it really matters how they handle it. They didn't hide from it. They didn't try to spin it. They didn't double speak it. It's not what you expected. We understand you expected better. In the meantime, use these other things from some of our fine competitors. I mean, that's class.
That is definitely class. We have a list in the show notes of some alternatives that you can use. And this particular article talks about the ones that aren't in the Map Store. I just named several of them, actually. Looking at Google Maps and Nokia Maps, and Bing Maps was the other that was mentioned here in the article. So these aren't apps. These are just using Safari on the device. You can still get a lot of the features that you would get from a full-featured Maps app.
I don't know how accessible these pages are. We haven't actually tried any of them.
Yeah, I haven't either.
I seem to recall somebody saying that the Nokia Maps wasn't terribly accessible, but
there was a problem with Nokia Maps about 7 or 8 months ago, whenever they first were released, I think, where it wasn't usable, and I forget why. It was either that you couldn't click on the button for walking directions, or there was something, a very glaringly obvious omission in terms of accessibility that Nokia Maps did. That may have changed since its initial release, because again, it is a web service, so they can do a lot of things behind the scenes, and the only way to really know what's going on is to try and use the service. So,
and the good news is that they are all free.
Yes, and if anyone has comments, if you've used any of these things, Google Maps, Bing Maps, Nokia Maps, send us an iReport through iBlink Radio, or you can actually write to us at resources@saratalk.com. We'd love to get your feedback. So someday we'll be able to stop talking about Lightning connectors.
But not
today.
That
day is not today. The headline for this article kind of makes me cringe. Some
made me mad.
Early iPhone 5 adopters stuck by Lightning, literally.
Yeah, first of all, it's got the word literally, and second of all, it's a horrible pun.
Yes.
And third of all, it's just a rotten headline.
And it's not really true, because
it's not accurate. It's not the Lightning connector that's the problem. It's the other end.
It's the USB end.
Right. This made
more
me
sloppy
really angry
journalism
because,
at its finest.
Yeah. Well, people just skimming headlines will see this and they'll say, I'm not going to get a new iPhone. Something's wrong with it. Somebody used an iPhone and they were struck by lightning. I mean, this is how urban legends get started. To me, this author's credibility just went down the tubes.
Yep.
Somebody was trying to be clever and failed.
Yeah.
So what's actually happening now that we have ranted about it for a bit is that the USB end of the Lightning adapter plug is getting stuck in some machines, and users have talked about, some of them can yank it out. Some of them have actually taken their machines into an Apple retail store to get it out.
Some have used pliers.
Apple's doing that and giving them a replacement cable. They theorize that this is happening because there are some, not pins, but something
springy
is
deals.
Shaped slightly differently. Yeah, what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's
the
springy deals that are
that poke in
that's
there.
Right. Yeah, that's
they,
the technical
they grab
term.
The internal guts of the USB port a little more snugly or something.
Yes. And so Apple is probably, as they're rolling out more batches of these, they're probably altering that a little bit.
I do hope that whoever tried to remove their cable with pliers did have the sense to turn the computer off. I was getting a little few scary images. We may be seeing a lot more curly-haired people walking around.
Lightning
and, you know,
struck
yeah,
me.
Exactly.
That's right.
And, you know, this is, again, sort of off the beaten path, but one thing that I've done and I've advised people to do is if you have a USB cable or USB device that you're plugging and unplugging from your computer a lot, I would suggest putting one of those little sticky lock dots or a piece of tape on what would be the top of it, the way that it plugs in. Because if you do that, then you'll always know which way it goes in and you won't be having to figure it out each time and maybe half the time attempting to force it in a way that it should not go. This is obviously not what people are doing with Apple devices, but it's just one of those things that can make your life a little simpler. I still have the old iPhone 4, and on my cable I have one dot on the USB to show the way that it goes into the computer, and then I have one on the end where the iPhone connector itself is so that I'm not half the time trying to force the connector in a way that it really shouldn't go.
Wow, you're way more organized than I am.
Well, it's you know what? And it's just a little bit faster. Plus, I've used my available handy USB ports, so, you know, I've got to, like, do the reach around the back into the maze of cords and plug it in.
Yes.
And it just, to me, it's easier. And I've heard of some people who just, you know, they don't mean to be, but they're kind of rough with their equipment. So if you're very gently putting a USB device in, you're fine. But if you just kind of figure that brute force is the way to go, you might
I'll make it fit.
Try, exactly. You might want to try some sort of
everything's going
marker.
Fit.
Exactly.
I think we should actually call this week's podcast This Week in Linkbait, because the next article is another of these that really grabs the attention and turns out not to be quite as advertised. It's many Android owners planning exodus to the iPhone.
Right.
And so I just
let
imagine
my
this
people
stampede. Yes. The truth is that only 22% of the people surveyed were looking at switching from an Android to an iPhone. Now, for the iPhone set, 9% said they were going to go get an Android instead of the iPhone. But to me, 22%, this is...
It's hardly an exodus.
It's not an exodus. It may spell a trend or it may not, but it's not an exodus.
And more users have multiple devices, too.
That's another thing that I was thinking about. You know, some of these people may say, I want an iPad, but it's cheaper with my carrier or whatever other reasons to actually use an Android as my phone. So who knows? You know, 66% of statistics are just made up on the spot anyway, so it's all good.
Well, your number's awful low. I thought it was 86.2.
It could be. 78.623? Yes.
In other words,
that's the magic
read
number.
The fine print, not just the title.
Yes. NFC, near field communications, is one of those things that we tend to talk about frequently on the podcast, and we theorize a lot and don't really have any answers per se, but this is one of those things that people want to be able to use for mobile payments and all sorts of things, and it's beginning to get a little more popular. The problem is that there are some researchers who were deliberately trying to do this. They're deliberately trying to find holes in the system, and they were able to bypass this NFC control. Basically, there were transit tickets that are using NFC, and this group of researchers managed to reprogram the ticket using an app they developed running on an Android phone, and they change the expired ticket to a valid ticket, so they were able to continue riding the transit system for free. Obviously, they're not releasing this to the public.
This isn't really anything new, though. I mean, like, hackers have hacked systems since the beginning of time. I think
that's what they do.
That's what they do.
Yes.
Well, and no system's foolproof. For example, I think Kevin Mitnick. I don't want to misattribute this, but I think it was Kevin Mitnick was talking about how he first learned to hack
the phone system.
The bus system. The buses by looking at the transfer slips and seeing how that worked, and you know the driver would punch out whatever number, and then you couldn't use the transfer on that bus, and so on and so forth. And so he figured out how to fake out paper bus transfers. So this isn't really, it's just the technology is different, and so they use that and try to make it a lot scarier than it is. But it's not new.
Well, to me, it's kind of comforting that they're finding holes. I think that you're absolutely right. Hackers hack, and they're always going to. But the idea is that if this is going to be something that's rolled out and used by people, I like that people are trying very hard to break it now.
For sure.
There are always going to be new and interesting ways to break it. But the more kinks we can get out of it early on, the better.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And anything that can make the system more secure and robust is a good thing. No, for sure.
Coming up after the break, we're going to talk lots of AT stories and, as Joe predicted last week, Facebook.
Oh, here's a shocker right there.
Looking for a cross-platform solution to quickly convert printed materials and PDFs into text, MP3, or DAISY formats? Check out Cerotech's DocuScan Plus. For just $299, use DocuScan Plus on your Windows or Mac computer. Store documents in the cloud for easy retrieval and access them from anywhere. For more information, visit www.docuscanplus.com.
Welcome back to Podcast 126. And we have lots of information to bring you, as Ricky said, in the world of assistive tech, and are essentially starting in our own backyard. We want to remind you about our podcasts and let you know that there is a brand new SPN special that has been released where Mike
Calvin... Hosted by...
Jamie Pauls. No. He's figured out how to bilocate. He can be two places at once. It's very interesting.
Sweet.
I'm Jamie Pauls.
Yeah.
Superman is jealous.
Exactly.
You better patent that.
Mm-hmm. So Mike and Ricky and I discussed mobile devices, basically the new iPhone and iOS 6 and Android. And we talked about what's currently going on and what we can kind of see happening in the way of future trends.
We also released a big old pile of podcasts, including High Contrast, episode 4, That Android Show, episode 11, Triple Click Home, episode 10.
Speaking of big old piles.
That's big old piles of goodness. It was a fantastic podcast. That was the testosterone edition. Alina Roberts was unable to participate in that one. So you had all sorts of testosterone-fueled males pontificating about Apple, which is exactly what you want. So go check all that out. You'll love it. Kathy Ann Murtha recently released a textbook that you'll certainly want to check out if you want to get the most out of System Access. This is called Immersion into System Access. You can pick that up on Kathy Ann's site. Check the show notes for a link to that.
I like the fact that you could look at the contents and get an idea of what would be covered. I thought that was helpful.
Yeah, that was actually very clever.
Yeah, and the fact that it's available in when you download it, you get MP3 and various text formats.
So let's talk about Facebook without cursing for once. I feel a little weird. The world seems off somehow. Actually, I'm quite excited about this. There is a discussion with Jeff Wieland, who is the head of Facebook's accessibility team, and he's talking about designing for accessibility.
Facebook has an accessibility team?
They do now. Yes, indeed, they do. This is exciting. They haven't had one for long, I don't think. Or if they've had one for long, it certainly hasn't been publicized.
Jeff in a back closet somewhere.
Yeah, those poor guys. But I like how they're approaching this, and I'm feeling a little bit optimistic after reading this Q&A. Now, certainly, Jeff wants to portray himself and his team in the best light and so on, but what he says is very promising in that the biggest thing that they're trying to do is do some internal educating of other UI designers and engineers and that sort of thing, just letting them know what kinds of things should we think about in terms of accessibility. And the engineers usually say, oh, I didn't even know I was supposed to think about that, or I didn't know it was that easy. Now we can incorporate what we've learned as we continue to design for Facebook. It looks like they are using VoiceOver both on a mobile and Mac devices to do a lot of this testing, which makes sense because it is built in, it's free, and it's easy to access. But they're testing with other screen readers as well. Certainly check out this article to get an idea of what Facebook hopes for in the future in terms of designing for accessibility.
You know, I like this approach. Rather than having accessibility, just worrying about accessibility, they want to sort of spread the love and make sure that other people are also worrying about accessibility so that it sort of gets incorporated in, hopefully, gets incorporated in at the beginning, and that people are thinking about it in just in their day-to-day workings, and it's not something like, oh, we've done all this work here, accessibility team, look at it and make sure that it does accessible things.
And if it doesn't, let us know, but we're not actually going to do anything
about it.
About
right,
it
exactly.
Until maybe a long time from now. At which
next
point,
we're
redesigning
cycle.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, you kind of get the vision of, instead of it being an accessibility team that is off in some sort of closet doing their designing and basically fighting this battle and swinging at windmills, it seems like they're saying this has to be a site-wide, a company-wide commitment. And that's really good. And I saw, too, some of the user comments, you know, they're saying this isn't just for blind people. This helps other people, too, and bringing up the universal design aspect of it, which I think is really good because whenever you aim for accessibility for one kind of person, you can tend to box yourself in. And so mm-hmm. by just embracing universal design, they can only benefit from that.
They call that the wheelchair ramp effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have ramps, so it's accessible to everyone.
Yep. Well, yeah, but the other side of that is we have ramps that were put in for those darn handicapped people, you know, and
we're not spending any more money on this.
Well,
we've done
where I was going was that moms with strollers use them.
Ah, yes. Okay. I was being the ranty one and you were actually pointing out the positives. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they get complained about in the design phase and so for those handicapped people, you know, you gotta accommodate them, and they put them in and moms with wheelchairs use them. So
yep, strollers.
Not bad.
Such.
I mean, moms with strollers, yeah. Moms with wheelchairs, too, I expect, but...
Yes, they do, I would think.
But moms with strollers and shopping carts and things of that nature. Little red wagons.
People on crutches, even just from a temporary injury.
Sure. If you use the Cube Twitter client, there's a lovely little update for you supporting snd.up support. This is another audio service. You can grab it either via audio update or... There's a link in the show notes for downloading the client if you don't currently have it installed.
So how long until blind people break this audio service?
They've already done it.
About as long as it takes to fill up whatever server it's being hosted on. If you're considering uploading copyrighted materials and things that really shouldn't be on a server and shared, think again.
Yeah, don't do that.
And why upload a lot of music to a server to share with other people when you could just get the Team FM app? This was released for iOS, and we now have some news about the Android app from Brian Hartgen. He talks about the fact that they have a very nice functional 1.0 for Android. The issue is that there are some features here that aren't accessible on a lot of the Android devices. And this is a really, it's an unfortunate spot to be in, but it happens to every Android developer. When you look at a platform that is very fragmented and you want to do your best to support as many people as possible, it can be kind of a challenge to make sure that you've developed things that work across these various versions of, say, TalkBack or the base Android operating system itself and so on. So Brian and the team are continuing to work on the Android app, and it will be available when it is deemed ready for all you happy Android users.
So it sounds like you might have a wait, but that when it does come, it will be worth that wait, which is always a good thing. I was really pleased to find a Hadley seminar that talked about Facebook on the iPhone. My battles with Facebook have, at least in my mind, been the stuff of legend. I've joked more than once that to me, Facebook is the new F word. just because it's so big, and you know, you go in one day and you're doing something a certain way, and then you go in the next day and it has changed completely. But Amy Salmon of Hadley does a very good presentation where she details accessing Facebook from the iPhone using the iPhone app itself for Facebook. And really, it's very nice. I've started going through and putting friends into groups, which I've wanted to do for a while, so that I could post certain things to certain people. Now I just need to find a way to get rid of the 30 references I see in a two-hour time period where someone has posted a photo. But this really,
I want to get rid of all the Farmville and Mafioville and Villeville and all
I
that
think
stuff.
There's Townville.
Yeah. Isn't there a way?
City Town.
I've gotten rid of invitations. I think there's a way, or there was a way, that you could get rid of those. That's the thing. It's still, there's so much information. I would love one great big uncluttered list with checkboxes where you could go through and say, I want this and this and this. It's kind of like the Facebook buffet. You know, I want this and this and this, but that's just yucky.
I want chicken wings.
We should tell Jeff Wieland about that and say, do that, accessibility guy. We want it.
Exactly.
And guess what? It benefits everybody.
Oh, my goodness. Well, people don't have private Facebook at all because they don't
They don't know what to turn off or where.
Yeah. I've talked to, I mean, my mother's on Facebook, which in and of itself is a little scary. But, I mean, she doesn't turn on any of this. And I called her the other week because I saw a link and it said, so-and-so said evil things about, and it was my mother's name, and I called her, and I said, do not click on that link. You know, it is, there's just so much that I think it's hard to find your way successfully through the maze so that you get to the piece of cheese at the end, but this seminar and the iPod app have gone a long way toward making that easier.
And if you do happen to find your way through the maze to Amazon.com's wall, you can join in the discussion about Kindle accessibility there. And actually, we've made it pretty easy for you to do that because we're including a link in the show notes. There was a thread started by Mike Calvo on, again, Amazon's public wall talking about Kindle Fire accessibility. And this is a way to sort of put this in the public eye. I think that we've advocated for accessibility for the Kindle in such a way that it has never really been in the public eye. We've communicated with Amazon to no avail, and we've certainly communicated amongst ourselves, but the problem is that the general public has no idea what's going on, and Amazon isn't necessarily, you know, given that this hasn't been publicized, they may not have much of a reason to do something about this. Well, nobody important is yelling at us about it, or perhaps more accurately, nobody in great numbers is yelling at us about it. So we really don't have to do anything. In any case, you can check out the Facebook thread and submit your own comments there. Cinemark is installing audio description technology across the United States. They're starting in California, I believe, and This technology does exist in some theaters now, but this is becoming more of a mandate, I think. Have either of you ever been to a theater where you could put on the headphones and have the audio description right there in the theater?
This is Erie, Pennsylvania. Are you kidding?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
well.
I unfortunately have not either. I know that in Philadelphia it's available. It may be available in Harrisburg. I don't know. I'm more of a book reader than a movie person, maybe in part because I'm cheap and, you know, the price of movie tickets is like, wow. But if there was a movie that I wanted to see and I could see it in description, I certainly would. And they're saying also that this will be in first run theaters by 2013. So if you're talking second run theaters, which are often in smaller
cities,
the
dollar theater or whatever.
Yeah, it could take even more than that, just like some of the smaller cities, it could take a while. But actually, there is a Cinemark, not about a half an hour from me. It will be interesting to see if they get this technology.
Yeah, or how quickly that happens.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see this actually rolling out. And I'm not sure where a Cinemark is in my area. I've never watched one of these audio described in the theater, but it sounds like an interesting experience.
I bet they have a locator. You could probably go to cinemark.com and type in your zip code.
That would be, yeah, that would make a whole lot of sense. There's going to be a special forum on disabilities where the presidential candidates can discuss their views on this topic. Unfortunately, they're not going to be there. They will be sending surrogates to the event to represent them for
And that pretty much
Romney.
Tells me all I need to know about both
yeah.
of them.
Yeah,
it's sad. I mean, to us, it's a primary interest that they be present. On one hand, I'm disappointed that they won't be. On the other hand, unless disability directly affects one of them or someone they love, we're probably just considered another special interest.
I think except that is sad, so, but true.
Yeah, except that in a lot of cases, disability issues can dovetail with healthcare issues, which are definitely a hot topic this year. And in one sense, this year of all years, it surprises me that neither candidate will be present.
I don't know. I'm not very surprised at all.
Disappointed, well, perhaps, but not surprised.
Yeah, I guess I feel like if they were going to come any year, this is one of those times when actually showing up would derive maximum benefit. But that's me.
If you're looking for some tech-savvy ways to follow the election, we've got a quick little video here in the show notes that you can check out. It talks about the Twitter feeds, Instagram pages. There are even apps for each of the candidates that you can check out and keep up with the latest. Coming up after the break, stay tuned for the mailbag and roundabout.
Wildfires burn millions of acres across the country each year. And each year, wildland firefighters battle to contain them, but they can't do it alone. For some communities, it's not a question of if wildfires strike, but when. Get fire adapted. Learn what you can do now to reduce wildfire damage later at fireadapted.org. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council. Learn more at fireadapted.org.
Welcome back to Podcast 126. And it's that time that we all know and love. It's time for the mailbag. This week, we start out with an iReport from Veronica, and she's making comments about Christine Ha and MasterChef.
Hey, Zero Talk. It's Veronica, and this is my iReport for the Zero Talk Podcast Network. Awesome podcast, as always. I love it. You guys were talking about Christine. I think it's awesome that she won. That was actually my first time watching MasterChef. I've never actually seen it. And I thought it was awesome that they had a blind contestant on the show. I think it's sad, though, that no matter how good she gets, she's always going to have to prove herself to everyone. Unfortunately, that's the way it is with us blind people. We always have to go above and beyond. I don't know why that is, but it's really sad. I hope one day we won't have to do that and we'll be accepted like everyone else. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say. Keep up the good work, and I will talk to you guys later.
Thanks, Veronica. And you're right. It is very discouraging, but I hope that at some point I think we're always going to face some challenges, but I hope that at some point the challenges are different in that respect than they are today. Next, we have an email from, I apologize, I'm not sure if it's Ali or Ali, because I have seen Ali spelled in just this way. But in any case, appreciate your sending the email. And the question is, since Apple has released their own Maps application, do third-party applications like Navigon still have a part to play? And my thought is yes. I'm not sure your feeling on this, Lisa, but my feeling is that while it's great to have a native Maps app, if a company has developed something, their idea is to be the best Maps or GPS provider ever, and especially if this is a paid app, they've sort of got to justify that price. And what you'll see that you won't necessarily see with a stock Maps app is more points of interest, the ability to fine-tune things a little bit in terms of points of interest, you know, announce the gas stations along my route or something like that. So I think that there's just going to be some specialized functionality that third-party navigation apps do better.
I think in general, more options are always a good thing. You've heard us say here before that the days of one screen reader are all but gone. Some people feel the same way about browsers. I definitely think it's true in apps. For example, I mentioned earlier the Facebook app on the iPhone, but I also have VoiceBook VO, which is great because if I just want to read the stories, the headlines, and I don't want to configure anything else or go through, I can just go in there and flick down, and I've very quickly gone through my stories. So I do think that there are good reasons to have more than one app. The one is that sometimes accessibility in one app will either temporarily or permanently break. And the other is that apps may look at the same information and treat it slightly differently and handle it in different ways. So it's just a matter of having options open so that if one day you wake up and the app that you use to do several things does no longer work for you, that you do have other options. The other reason that I think that companies like Navigon still have a place is that if you do have accessibility concerns, sometimes you will find that these developers have the time and the ability to be more responsive to user feedback than can, let's say, a large company like Apple. Not that they can't and not that they don't, but I think that sometimes the developers of single apps can do it in a more timely manner.
Agreed. And last but not least, we have an email from John Miller, and he says he was just recently listening to the podcast, and first he wants to mention that he's in the midst of a job search, and when John was on an interview, he was asked what screen reader he used. He mentioned System Access, and immediately the person on the other side of the desk knew that was Saratech. And the second point that he wants to make is that he is one of the people who has just upgraded from a Samsung Haven, which sort of did what he needed. He could read his incoming texts if all was going well and the stars were aligned properly, and battery life not so good, but he was able to get an iPhone 4 on contract for free because of the recent price changes. And he mentions this because a couple of podcasts ago, we were talking about what it can mean for offering free or low cost or discounted something for people with disabilities. And in this instance, he's talking about how the iPhone is going to give him new and innovative ways to seek employment and do other things as well. And I think this is an interesting point. I mean, the phone is free for everyone now. However, he wouldn't have been able to get this phone in his current circumstances. And once it was free, he's able to get this and use it to improve his situation. So I don't think this situation about never offering discounts or always offering discounts, it can't be as black and white as that. I suppose the issue, though, is more one of being economically disadvantaged rather than focusing specifically on a disability and having that as the reason for your being economically disadvantaged, even though in some cases it certainly is, because employers may be afraid to hire people with disabilities and so on. So again, I think that this is just one of those things that can't be black and white.
Yeah, you know, I listened with interest when this was discussed on former podcasts. And you don't really know the motivation of the person or the organization that's offering the free service. There are also free services for senior citizens or discounted services. And, you know, you could say, well, they give those services because, well, they're just old and how much can they get out of it? Or you can say they offer those services as kind of a nod, like, okay, you may not be making as much money as you were, and, you know, you've been in our world for a long time and we'd like to honor you. And it could be a similar thing with disabilities, like, you know, we know they cost more, or it could be a patronizing thing, you don't know. I follow John on Twitter, so it's been interesting to see the whole iPhone experience playing out for him. You know, he was asking, how do you do this or how do you do that? Or I'm trying to do this and it won't, you know, it's not working like I think, or it's taking me a long time to get this. And it was really interesting because it kind of brought me back to when I was first learning. He also was talking about, he's been doing some moving, and he was talking about having limited access to the internet and being able to use his phone to basically stay connected. He had to arrange transportation to these job interviews. And if he couldn't have done it through text messaging, he said it might not have happened. And so he really, I feel, has kind of given the iPhone credit for helping him to go in the right direction and to move forward.
Absolutely. And now it's time for Roundabout. In our first story, and I keep trying to resist saying this app is out for blood, but I can't seem to resist saying that. This is an app to manage diabetes for your iPhone. It's called Glooko, G-L-O-O-K-O, and it is now working with 17 different glucose meters and probably more to come. Basically, you're able to use this cable with the glucometer and your phone. And what the app does is keep a log of your measurements so it can be uploaded to the doctor and all that happy stuff.
This was just a mainstream article and did not specifically discuss accessibility, but we would love to hear from any of you who are using this or a similar app with a glucometer, and is the process accessible? It seems lately there's been this proliferation of health apps. We had this one today. There was one recently about hearing. There was one about, you know, taking your pulse just by the iPhone.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, someone told me about one that...
Like looking at your face.
Yeah, someone told me about one that'll take your pulse or
well,
measure your
heart rate. Well, there
are
some of those. Like, there's one where you can put your finger on the camera and it will measure your pulse. But the one, you just hold it in front of your face and it will measure. And so...
Jeez, how does that work?
I have no idea.
It somehow looks at changes in your skin each time blood flows through it, I guess.
But I feel like more than any other, these health apps are really kind of pushing the iPhone to its limits, and it's or Android, pushing smartphones to their limits. And it's really fascinating to see the direction that's taking.
Speaking of pushing things to their limits and doing very creative things, our last story is about an invention done by three 14-year-olds coming from the West Bank. So in Palestine, these three 14-year-old girls have invented a piece of technology that they're calling Stick Tech. And this is a similar concept to things that we have seen before with two sensors. You have a ground sensor and you have the sensor for what is in front of you. Then you have a handle which vibrates to indicate various things. And these girls are headed to a science fair here in California. And I think it's very interesting that the girls are actually living in a refugee camp, and certainly often you think, you know, this could be a place of hopelessness where the people who are in the camps might very easily lose creativity, you know, be stifled by the conditions that they're living in and that sort of thing. And in this case, this is certainly not true. Their teacher talks about them, and they speak themselves about how and why they developed this. This is definitely a video worth checking out. Have both of you seen this?
Yes,
I have
absolutely.
Not yet. I have not yet, but I think that it's great that not just that it's kids, but that it's kids in that kind of a condition, that kind of a living condition.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're not talking about people in a lab or with like yeah. huge R&D budgets or anything like that. I just think that I love reading stuff like this.
And the fact that really they could be so self-absorbed by their situations, and they're not really rising above it. It was great.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic story. Do check out this video, and congratulations to the girls. Whether or not you win the fair in California, you've done great things, and I suspect you'll go on to do lots more.
Just real quick, thinking about how expensive this kind of technology usually is, and thinking about them coming from a refugee camp, for goodness sake, you can bet that the costs for building such a thing would be pretty low.
Good point.
Absolutely.
You know, I didn't even consider that, but you're right. Well, that's going to wrap things up in terms of the news this week, but we're not done yet. The real Jamie Pauls, not the Borg one, is going to be interviewing Marissa Slaughter, who is the new social media coordinator for APH and Fred's Head. So stick around. That's coming right up. So until next time, have a great week.
Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
I am pleased to be joined today by Marissa Slaughter, who is the social media coordinator for Fred's Head at the American Printing House for the Blind. Marissa, welcome to the Serotalk podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you and I have one thing in common. I think it's we haven't been doing what we are doing for a really long time. I'm coming up on a year. You're a bit less than that. How long have you been at APH?
Well, I actually started here last summer as an intern with the museum for 3 months, and then mm-hmm. I was officially hired as the social media coordinator full-time on July 9th, so almost 3 months here.
So for those who are just kind of sitting around eating popcorn, listening to this, and are asking the question, what exactly is a social media person? What do you do?
Well, a social media coordinator is kind of like the online face of an organization. So I'm in charge of the Facebook page, the Twitter page, which is at Fred's Head, mm-hmm. and the Fred's Head blog. And we also have a presence on Foursquare and Flickr and YouTube. So I control all those things and put up the content, right? The articles for Fred's Head, write the blog articles, and basically just talk to everybody online.
Do you find that checklists are kind of invaluable at times for you?
I have found that, at least for the blog, having a checklist of article ideas and articles that I've already written or already have an article for and kind of a calendar to space things out are very helpful.
Yeah. Or perhaps if you're posting three things sort of at once, it's like, okay, let's write this down so we get this in order and don't get our wires crossed sometimes.
Right, yeah.
Definitely.
Make sure you don't double post something.
Exactly. So I guess probably most people know, but let's talk just a little bit about what Fred's Head, the database / blog, is.
It started out as a database, and then it moved to a blog on Blogger. It's named for Fred Gassoni, who worked here at APH. He just recently retired this past January, I think.
Right.
And he was very, very smart, knew everything, worked here for years. So we named the blog after him. So it's basically supposed to be all the stuff, all kinds of information, tips and tools for people who are blind, even, you know, articles of interest. We're doing more history of things in the blindness field. And so basically we try to make it anything and everything relevant to people who are blind.
Okay, excellent. So there's got to be a ton of stuff there. I mean, it's been a while since I've looked, but I know there's got to be a lot of content there, right?
There is. If you haven't looked in a while, you might want to go check it out again. There are 4,600 or so posts since 2005. So there's a lot in there, and it's a lot to look through.
Yeah. So in the course of a day, do you just kind of find yourself going with the rhythm of, like, whatever the news cycle is for that day? How do you kind of find yourself balancing Twitter and Facebook and all of the different avenues that you post to?
Well, I guess I have a little bit of a routine set up. When I get in the mornings, I check Facebook to see if anybody had commented on something or what the likes and the all that overnight when I wasn't here. And then I go on Twitter and see the news stories and what everybody's talking about. And I get a bunch of emails for news stories, alerts, I guess. So I read through those and see what's relevant. And after I kind of catch up on what's going on and the news stories and all that, then I focus more on the blog and writing articles or getting articles together, spacing them out. And I do that for basically the rest of the day, but I can't do something for 8 hours straight without kind of breaking it up. So I'll switch right back and forth between Twitter and Facebook and the blog and just throughout the day.
You know, you mentioned something that really brings up a good point. The community really does do a great job of giving input. I know with Serotalk, when I'm getting stories together, the community really does send suggestions, and it's pretty nice to have that feedback from your audience, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I love it, going on and seeing what everybody's talking about. And when I got this job, I didn't know it was going to be more, well, not more, but I didn't know it was going to have a lot of kind of customer service to do with it, which I don't mind. I kind of like it. But if somebody asks a question on Facebook about a product, or mostly people on Twitter asking questions about products, and, you know, if they have one or when we're going to send them theirs or something's broken. And so that's, you know, getting the feedback and seeing how the products that we make and the services that we provide, actually you can see it in use. And so it just, I really like it being relevant, I guess.
That really makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So you really, as you say, you really are the face of the company, or at least your position is kind of a lot of people's probably first introduction or maybe a first impression to what's going on over there at APH. Would that be kind of a fair assessment maybe?
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of people that go out. We have a whole field services department that they're the ones who go to schools, schools for the blind and just regular public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And to teachers of the blind and the blindness community, and they go out and show products and talk about APH. So they're a big part of it. But as far as social media, which is, you know, huge, at least for, you know, online internet stuff, that's my area.
So how do you go about balancing the Fred's Head person on Twitter with Marissa Slaughter on Twitter? Do you find that a little hard to juggle, or is that something you don't really have much trouble with?
Sometimes I have to keep my mouth shut. I will freely admit that.
Uh-huh.
There, you know, as the Fred's Head Twitter person, I can't comment on politics. I can't comment on religion. I can't comment on some things in the blindness community that would be kind of a conflict of interest or not good, considering that I'm representing APH. So sometimes people will say something and, oh, it kills me that I can't respond. But if, other than that, though, Twitter is a pretty free form. And for the most part, I can, even if it's not directly about APH or about blindness, I can respond as long as it's not controversial. Like, somebody had,
sure,
they were asking about something about baseball, how to watch the games and know what's going on and listening to radio play-by-plays. And, you know, I can comment on that, and it's more personal. It's not so much professional, but It's not hard mm-hmm. until somebody says something that really, I really wish I could say something about, but I can't.
Yeah, you do kind of have to sit out the drama sometimes, don't you? Even though you'd like to jump right in the middle
yeah.
of it. I totally get where you're
yeah,
coming from.
I'm kind of a...
But you know what? That's probably for the yeah. best most of the time,
yeah.
actually.
I'm kind of a passionate person. So sometimes I really wish I could say something, but I know I can't. I know it's probably a good thing that I can't.
Yeah. Right. So you've mentioned Facebook several times, and that is definitely not the easiest site to maneuver. What techniques have you found to make that most useful?
Well, I am personally, I use Zoom, so I do have some usable vision, which makes Facebook a lot more usable for me than I know it is for a lot of people who are blind and visually impaired.
Sure.
So.
Yep.
Basically, I use a lot of Zoom, but it's really annoying when they keep changing the setup and things aren't always where they used to be, and it's not the most user-friendly place.
But yet, it is so important. I mean, there are so many people on Facebook now, so it's not something a person can ignore.
Right.
I definitely also have kind of a love-hate relationship with it. I actually want to be able to use it more than I do, and I'm actually finding ways to make myself use it a little more. But yeah, it's definitely a challenge, so I can see that being able to have some usable vision is a good thing there. What have you found that are perhaps some challenges of being a social media coordinator, or maybe some things that surprised you about your job?
I think I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest surprises for me was the customer service aspect of it. And it makes total sense now that I think about it, that, you know, if you're online and doing the social media, a lot of people are using social media for customer service questions instead of calling or filling out forms or on websites and that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. once I thought about it, it made sense. But I guess I just wasn't expecting having to address people's complaints or concerns or questions. And I really like it. I just wasn't expecting it.
Right.
As far as a challenge, I think one of the things that's challenging about especially the blog is that there has been so much already put into it. Michael McCarty was there for 7 years, and he put tons of information in there. So sometimes I'll think of something that I think will be a great article, and it's already been written. So trying to keep it new and fresh and not redoing everything is definitely a challenge.
Now, you and I have a little different approach because I do a lot of audio, but I suspect that you may be able to identify with this. Have you found that you've had to become Marissa Slaughter on Fred's Head and not try to kind of quote channel unquote what Michael did in the past?
Definitely. You know, with yeah. any change in personnel or whatever, you're never going to do the same thing the person preceding you did, even if they did a very good job. I mean, it's nothing
right.
against that person. It's just you can't expect two people to do the exact same thing. So as far as the blog, I think one of the main things that differs a little bit in my put a little bit of Marissa Slaughter into the blog is my bachelor's degree is in history. So I love history. So I've been trying to write a little bit more about the history of blindness and history stuff in general and kind of adding a history approach to the blog.
And there is a ton of history at APH, as I found out this summer when I had the privilege of doing the tour.
Yes,
there's a lot
definitely.
There.
That was a great podcast, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I certainly had a lot of fun doing that. Mike Hudson was wonderful to take the tour with.
Mm-hmm.
So
he was
great
my
experience.
Supervisor last summer when I was intern in the museum. So.
So I suppose we should go ahead and just give people some contact information. What are some ways for them to start to learn about APH and take advantage of Fred's Head?
Well, I guess there's a lot, but you can find us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/American Printing House. And we're also on Twitter at Fred's Head. And the blog address is www.fredshead.info.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'd really like to thank you for taking the time to join us. It's been enjoyable for me to actually visit with someone else who does something similar to what I do and kind of compare notes. I think you and I had some similar experiences, although definitely we do some different things as well. Do you think podcasting is something that you would be interested in a little bit at some point?
Maybe. We'll see. I've only been here for 2 months, so I want to settle in before launching into that. But it would be interesting.
It definitely is. Actually, it's a lot of fun, but it is definitely a lot of work. So I would say don't jump into that arena unless you're good and ready. But excellent. So I encourage people to go visit all of those different places that you just gave. There are a lot of them. Definitely follow on Twitter because you tweet a lot of great links. I know for the Sarah Talk podcast, we use a lot of the links that Fred's Head tweets for stories, and I really appreciate those. You have some great content there.
Oh, thank you.
I've been visiting with Marissa Slaughter, social media coordinator for the Fred's Head blog at the American Printing House for the Blind, here on the Sarah Talk podcast.
You've been listening to Sarah Talk. Visit us at www.sarahtalk.com. Send us an email at resources@sarahtalk.com. Send us an iReport with iBlink Radio, available in the Apple App Store and the Android Market. Or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us next week as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.